This is Health Matters, a podcast from Mayo Clinic where we discuss the latest medical advice, news, and research to help you live a happier and healthier life. My name is Kristen Meinzer. I'm a writer and journalist. And this episode, we're talking about sleep. More than one-third of Americans say they have difficulty sleeping, and that makes sense in a country where we're expected to prioritize work and stay constantly connected. And when we finally get the time to rest, a lot of us aren't even sleeping well. Joining us today is Dr. Timothy Morgenthaler, a pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He's the director of Mayo Clinic's Center for Sleep Medicine and one of the medical editors of the new book, Mayo Clinic Guide to Better Sleep. We'll talk with him about why we aren't sleeping well and what we can do about it. Dr. Morgenthaler, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Morgenthaler, I want to start off with a story you share in your book about your very first case, which taught you about how poor sleep can actually be the cause of many other seemingly unrelated health problems. The story starts with a patient who had developed psychosis, but his doctors couldn't understand how he got that way or how to treat him. So they came to you. What happened there?
Back then, not a lot of people knew any sleep medicine specialists, and I think some of them regarded it perhaps somewhat suspiciously as, is this really medicine? You know, is this really something that doctors do? And of course, I was quite convinced it was. Well, a very astute psychiatrist had a patient in the hospital who they were struggling with trying to help that patient get better. And they observed that one of the things they thought might be a problem is that the patient did not seem to sleep for any longer than about 5 minutes at a time.
Wow.
So I went there, and lo and behold, as a result of my interview and examination, I thought that the patient probably had very severe sleep problem called restless leg syndrome, had it very severely. And I suggested a medication that is helpful in treating patients with that disorder. And within a matter of just a couple days, the patient was actually beginning to sleep, and he was able to participate in the treatments and the therapy that the psychiatrist had been trying to do. And it really turned him around. He was out of the hospital very shortly thereafter, and he ended up being a long-term patient of mine. I learned from him that he had several relatives who had the same disorder, and they ended up coming to see me. And so word spread that, hey, there's something to this sleep medicine, that they have special knowledge about certain things that can be very helpful. And so that was really just a remarkable kind of first case in the community that I happened to land in at that time.
What a fantastic experience for a first case.
Well, and that is a lot why, you know, as I've been boarded in pulmonary and critical care and sleep medicine, but over the past 10 years or so, I've really focused on sleep medicine. And a good part of the reason for that is practicing sleep medicine, you just time and time again see how much impact you can make on people's quality of life and on the management of their other diseases. So it's really, to me, an exciting area. I obviously am biased. I love the field of sleep and sleep medicine.
Well, let's get down to basics. Why is sleep so important?
Well, here's kind of something fascinating. We've been spending about a third of every day of our entire lives sleeping. So if it's a third of our lives, it must be pretty important. And it is. It's not just about feeling refreshed. It's really absolutely essential because every single system in our body needs sleep. It's nothing short of amazing. Let's just kind of start thinking about things. Physical restoration. First of all, you know, sleep is really when your body does its repair work. During sleep, and especially during deep sleep, our so-called slow wave sleep, I mean, your body is like a construction crew. It's busy fixing tissues, building muscle, repairing muscles that were, you know, torn or injured, strengthening bones. Growth hormone, which is kind of like one of the body's repair tools, is released primarily during sleep. Your immune system gets a boost while you sleep. It protects you from infections. It's producing cytokines that help reduce inflammation. And so when we skimp on sleep and your body doesn't really have all the time that it needs to heal and defend itself, you can get feeling a lot less healthy very quickly.
And how about our brain health? How does sleep affect that?
Our brain is super busy when we're sleeping. They used to think that sleep was a very passive activity, you know, kind of like nothing's happening. But actually, I'm sure every listener has noticed how much clearer they feel and how much clearer they think after a good night's sleep. And that's because when you're sleeping, your brain is busy processing and organizing all the information that you brought in during the day and kind of locking it into long-term memory. You know, especially during some stages of sleep, like REM sleep, oftentimes people think of it's kind of like there's a librarian in your brain going through and sorting and cataloging and storing things in the right location and giving you an index for how do you go find it. So your brain also, while you're sleeping, is taking out the trash, if you will. There's a system in the brain that's called the glymphatic system. Wasn't really hardly known about 10 years ago, but it's busy clearing out the waste products that accumulate while your brain is so busy thinking and doing and acting out things during the day. And some of those waste products, like beta amyloid proteins, have been linked to the development of Alzheimer's disease. So it's very important that, you know, sleep take place to kind of get the metabolic byproducts out of the brain. And then finally, you know, sleep, I think everybody knows they regulate your emotions. If any of you have children or partners or friends, we all know when they don't get enough sleep, they're just irritable, crabby, snappy. So I'm sure that sounds pretty familiar to you.
Oh, I've never been like that before. I don't know what you're talking about.
It also turns out that sleep is important for metabolism and weight. And I think people are becoming more aware of this in the last years. You know, getting good sleep is really, getting enough and good sleep is really part of us controlling our weight. When we don't get sleep, we get surges of leptin and ghrelin. These are two hormones that kind of manage your hunger. And without enough sleep, your body sort of cranks up the hunger hormone and kind of dials down the leptin, which is our kind of I'm full hormone. And actually, it's been shown in many experiments and probably from personal experience that when you don't get enough sleep, you tend to kind of crave less healthy food, you know, carbs and snacks that are high in fat and so forth. So, you know, it has been shown to have a lot to do with weight control and also with control of insulin and managing blood sugar.
Why does my body need to be asleep to do this?
We know that all these really important things happen when we sleep. But, you know, as you're asking me, like, why do we have to sleep? Why couldn't that happen during wakeful times? And some of the studies that have been done to try to answer that start looking at, you know, sleep across the animal kingdom. And it's very different depending on what animal you go to. We know we have some animals, like certain whales, will actually be able to swim with part of their brain asleep and the other part of their brain not asleep. So it seems to have to do with conservation of energy during a time when we're doing these things. And then, you know, when we're awake, our brain really evolutionarily is kind of oriented toward gathering food, socializing. So there's sort of different activities. It's almost like sleep is the introvert, let's heal ourselves part of life, and wakefulness is more of the, hey, let's absorb, conquer, relate, let's do all of those things.
Now, I have to confess something to you. As much as I love sleep now, when I was younger, I pulled a lot of all-nighters in college and post-college. I think a lot of young people have this idea that you can just soldier through if you don't get enough sleep. I certainly did. But sleep deprivation can be harmful beyond just being tired the next day. Can you explain why that is?
You can't really cheat on sleep without consequences. It is a biological necessity. And sure, you might manage for a day or two, but the effects of sleep deprivation go way beyond just feeling tired. And over time, they can be serious. So first of all, I want to just address the feeling tired part of that. Some very interesting experiments done by a really smart guy whose name was David Dinges. And he was set up, I think, largely under contract from the Department of Defense to look at this question of, you know, what are the effects of sleep deprivation? Kind of probably, I don't know this for a fact, but probably probing the question, how little sleep can we get away with and still have our soldiers be, you know, top notch? But the interesting experiments that they set up was they would take relatively young, presumably healthy people, and then they would put them in this kind of environment where they didn't really know whether it was day or night outside, and they could control the temperature and their diets and everything. And then they would test things like cognition, reaction time, accuracy on tests, simulated driving tests, and things like this. And so they would say, you know, sure enough, you know, once they got about 7 hours of sleep, they were sort of maximum on these kind of tests. And then they would say, okay, now we're going to limit you to only 4 hours of sleep or 6 hours of sleep. And they would start dialing down the number of hours of sleep that they would allow. And what they found was that people would feel a little sleepy, but their performance would be way down compared to how sleepy they felt. And so what they learned from these experiments is it's a little like going to a party with maybe a friend who drinks too much. You know, they don't really know how drunk they are. They think they're fine, but you're looking at them and you know differently. And that's the same thing with sleep deprivation.
And so you said this is one consequence of sleep deprivation. What are the other consequences aside from feeling tired? What does the research have to say about that?
Well, and they've done this with large surveys of hundreds of thousands of people, and they've done it in a lot of different ways. And what they basically have found is that when you look at the number of hours that people sleep, that if you're getting less than 6 hours of sleep on average, that your likelihood to develop obesity, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, depression, all of these go up significantly. And so the kind of the sweet spot, in other words, where is the risk factor for those different diseases go down for adults is about 7 hours. It's right at about 7 hours. And so getting less than 7 hours and certainly less than 6 hours on average is not only bad for you in the short run, where you know maybe your loved ones don't want to be near you, but it actually contributes to the risk of disease. And I also forgot to mention a big concern in society today. Chronic lack of sleep has been linked to cognitive decline like Alzheimer's disease and things like that. So it's a big, big deal to be chronically sleep deprived.
So you just laid out what the bare minimum is for most people for sleep. But what is the ideal amount of sleep? And how does that vary from person to person? For example, my husband seems to be fine with 7 hours, but me, I'm just the most joyous, lovely person in the world if I get closer to nine.
The ideal number of hours of sleep is between 7 and 9. So it really is, it's a range though. It's not just individualized, you know. So this range of 7 to 9 is for 95% of the adult population, that's where they should aim, is someplace in there.
And does that change with age at all?
Things are different with the age spectrum. Any of you who've had children, you remember when they're first born, they sleep more than half the day. And, you know, 16 to 20 hours they're sleeping. Now, unfortunately, and we all have felt this pain, their sleep isn't all consolidated at one time. They sleep a little bit, and then they're awake a little bit, and then they're asleep a little bit, and they're awake a little bit. By the time they're in grade school, that's starting to kind of consolidate into a night and a day pattern, but they still need quite a lot of sleep. You know, we're talking 10 plus hours per day. And so sometimes they make that up with a little afternoon nap, and we all say, thank you, God, for this nap, because I needed it. And then they do the rest of it at night, or, you know, they have an early bedtime and a rise time that works for them. As people grow up in age and they're starting to get into the teen years, you know, they're still needing really more like 10-ish hours, 8 to 10 hours for sure. And then as we become young adults, it's, like I said, it's like 7 to 9 hours. It's really going to be the target zone.
Now, you mentioned baby sleep, teenage sleep, adult sleep. What about older adults?
The amount of sleep that we need to get doesn't change all that much, but the sort of conditions of sleep start changing a bit. We're not quite as efficient getting that 7 hours of sleep. We might have to spend a little longer in bed to get the 7 hours of sleep than we used to. Also, the timing of sleep may change a little bit. As we get older, maybe have less evening social activities, as there's some changes in our biological clock, older people may tend to want to go to bed a little earlier and wake up a little earlier, but they're still probably aiming mostly for about 7 to 9 hours of sleep.
I'm glad you brought up the going to bed earlier and waking up earlier thing, because a lot of us think of ourselves as either a night owl or a morning person. Is that a binary? Is that more of a spectrum? How would you describe that?
So people do have a natural predisposition to being either more of a morning person or more of a evening person. It can change a bit over time. We know, for example, adolescents, especially late in adolescence, there is a tendency for their clock to run a little bit later. They tend to want to be more awake and social and so forth in the evening hours, and they're very sluggish to get up in the morning. That's, you know, part of that's behavioral, but a lot of that is just part of our circadian rhythm drift. We tend to drift a little bit later in the teens. That's one of the reasons that, you know, these early school times have led in many cases to sort of sleep deprivation and some problems with these, you know, our kids performing their best in school.
And what about as we get older?
As we get, you know, on in years and we're, you know, approaching older age, our clock tends to shift just a little bit early. In between, for the most part, I think our evening tendencies or morning tendencies are mostly governed by our biology.
So I might, with age, become a little bit more of a morning lark, but not drastically so.
We have this clock, that's part of it, but it is regulated by things. And so one of the problems for many of our elderly, unfortunately, is that they don't have as rich social connections. And so they're not out with friends or they're not interacting with family members. And it kind of gets to be 8 o'clock and they're sort of, you know, like, I'm not quite sure what to do. And I think I'll just go to sleep. And then they're waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning saying, gee, I can't sleep. Well, actually they have slept. It's just that they're kind of done sleeping. And so their tendency, we'll say, has drifted earlier, but that's not necessarily entirely due to their biology. It could be with more stimulation, a little bit more light in the later part of the day, they might have a more typical sleep-wake pattern.
Have you ever heard of the nocebo effect? Think about the opposite of a placebo. It's when you have a negative side effect simply because you expected something to happen. Now, that may not seem very straightforward, but the nocebo effect can have a huge impact on the outcome of a health event, like getting a new vaccine or having surgery. If your interest is piqued, check out The Nocebo Effect, published by Mayo Clinic Press, to learn more about how words can make us sick through medicine, history, culture, psychology, and philosophy. Get your copy today at mcpress.mayoclinic.org and use code HEALTHMATTERS, all one word, for 10% off your order.
So, why is sleep so important? Well, that's when the body's maintenance crew gets to work. You've got a team of diligent workers, including repair technicians who fix tissues, build and repair muscle, and strengthen bones. There are also caretakers in charge of boosting your immune system and releasing growth hormones. Then there are the librarians, essential for our brain health, who process and organize information, like filing away the memories we gather throughout the day. The maintenance crew also helps with emotional regulation and even includes a janitorial staff that gets rid of waste products that can, if they build up, be linked to other diseases. Sleep also has a physical fitness team that manages our hunger, metabolism, and weight, which is why cheating sleep will always come with consequences. Even if you feel fine after a poor night's sleep, your performance will suffer. Studies show that regularly getting less than 6 hours of sleep can increase your likelihood of developing obesity, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and depression. So help out your maintenance crew by giving them enough time to do their job and aim to get at least 7 to 9 hours of sleep each night. Now that we've covered the basics, next, let's get into disordered sleep. Okay, Dr. Morgenthaler, now that we've covered the basics of sleep, let's dig in a little deeper and talk about disordered sleep. First of all, what's the difference between having trouble sleeping versus having a sleep disorder?
For an example, I'm going to use insomnia.
Yes, great.
So kind of a model that we use to think about insomnia, and I think this will help answer the question about, you know, difference between a sleep problem and a sleep disorder. We talk about what's called the 3P model. The first P is predisposition. You know, as a pulmonologist, I hate admitting this, but sleep is fundamentally a neurologic process. You know, our brain has to go through a very elaborate series of steps to fall asleep, and it needs certain steps to become maximally awake also. So we know some people who are just really good sleepers, those really annoying people that can sleep like on a concrete floor in the middle of a construction zone.
The minute the plane takes off, they're fast asleep. Those people, yes.
So these people have, you know, a very low predisposition to insomnia. But, you know, even those people, I suppose, but most of us for sure, there can be the second P, which is a precipitating cause. Usually we think about these precipitating causes as being something kind of stressful or bad. You know, maybe a loved one gets sick. One of your children is in trouble. Divorce. You're under trouble at the job. The IRS is auditing. You can make up your precipitating cause. And almost anyone, if they have the right precipitating cause, will kind of move from their predisposition where maybe they're usually pretty good sleeping, but they'll have some nights where they have a hard time sleeping.
Right, because being able to sleep requires you to quiet your mind, relax, and be comfortable. And if you're experiencing anxiety, it makes sense that you would have a harder time falling asleep because of all those stressors.
But fortunately, for most of the time, when the precipitating cause goes away, we kind of return back to whatever our predisposition was. We're back to sleeping well enough again. But for some people, during this time when they're struggling with the insomnia, without really knowing it, they start developing habits which are unhelpful. And we call those ones perpetuating causes. So you had the predisposition, you have a precipitating cause, and you have perpetuating causes. And with those, now they're experiencing 3 and more months of difficulty sleeping, poorly restorative sleep, difficult staying asleep. It's affecting their daytime. Now we have a sleep disorder.
So a few rough nights is one thing, something that's ongoing and possibly supported by certain not so good habits might be part of a larger disorder.
Yes.
Now, in your book, you mentioned some red flags to look out for that might indicate you're experiencing disordered sleep. What are some of these red flags?
What are the conditions under which you should be able to sleep and feel well rested? So one of them we've talked about is, you know, time. Am I providing enough time to get adequate sleep? I can't cram 7 hours of sleep into 5 hours. So if I'm only scheduling 5 hours of sleep and I'm only getting 5 hours, I shouldn't be surprised if I'm sleepy. I probably am going to be sleepy. But if I'm scheduling my life in such a way that I'm, you know, I should be getting enough sleep, and it's fairly regular, and I'm putting that effort in, and yet I'm not able to sleep. You know, my environment is good, my timing is good, the duration is good, but I'm not able to sleep well. That might be a sleep disorder. What if I think I am sleeping well, but I'm perpetually poorly rested? I'm sleepy, I'm yawning, I'm having a hard time staying awake. That might be a sign of a sleep disorder. Another, you know, there are certain sleep disorders that kind of have very apparent symptoms in some cases. So one I'm thinking of is obstructive sleep apnea syndrome. If you're someone who, you know, those who love you or observe you are saying, hey, you snore loudly, you're stopping breathing, you don't sleep very well, and you know you're tired, you probably have a sleep disorder. And for all those reasons, you should probably seek medical attention to see what the problem is.
I'm so glad you brought up sleep apnea because this is a term I think a lot of us hear but don't actually understand. What exactly is sleep apnea?
Let's just for the moment imagine that all of us are robots. If we're all robots, then our breathing is very regular with, you know, just rhythmic precision. We take a breath in, we breathe the bad air out. We breathe the good air in, we breathe the bad air out. For most of us, we're not robots. I know you're not. I know I'm not. We're not exactly precise like that, but our breathing is regulated to be pretty regular. It adapts a little bit. Otherwise, I would be talking very funny and you would be talking very funny. But it does regulate our breathing, especially during sleep, to be fairly regular. But what if there are big pauses in the breathing, or the breathing slows down, and by that I mean the breaths are so small that we're really not getting in all the good air and we're not getting rid of all the bad air, all the carbon dioxide. If that lasts 10 seconds, we've decided that that's an apnea. If there's 10 seconds that you're not breathing, that is defined as an apnea. It comes from the Greek word apneuma, no wind.
Oh, interesting.
It's actually considered normal in adults anyway to have up to maybe as many as 4 per hour of those, and it doesn't seem to have a big consequence on most people. But once we start crossing the threshold of 5 or more per hour, and especially if there's associated symptoms, that's when we start talking about that you have some kind of an apnea syndrome.
Let's go through some other disorders here. We've talked about insomnia, but we haven't really described what scientifically is happening there. Can you explain that to us?
In common language, we say somebody has insomnia if they have a hard time sleeping. But we know there can be a lot of different reasons for that. Chronic insomnia as a disorder is characterized by difficulty sleeping at least 3 nights per week over a 3-month period. And the difficulty is either difficulty getting to sleep or staying asleep or having satisfying sleep to the extent that it actually affects how you feel and act during the day. So it's sort of a functional definition. Now, what causes the insomnia? There's a lot of different underlying causes of insomnia, and that's one of the reasons it's fairly complicated to get a handle on how best to treat each person's insomnia. It's not like it's one single disease.
And earlier, at the top of our conversation, you mentioned restless leg syndrome, which not everybody even realizes is a sleep disorder. Can you explain how that's related to sleep?
It's a sensory-based syndrome, and it has some characteristic features. The person who has restless leg syndrome will observe an unpleasant sensation in the legs that is restless. It wants to be moved. It may feel like creepy, crawly sensation, or not really cramping, but it's almost like a pulling. Whatever it is, it does not want to be still. It wants to be moved. And that can become quite intense. You're ready to go to bed. You do your bedtime ritual. You're all ready. Oh, I can't wait to climb in bed. And as you start getting in bed, you realize that your legs cannot stay still. They need to move. I mean, they literally, every time you relax, they have to move, and they have to move, and they have to move. And that does create really significant problems for people getting to sleep.
Interesting. What about narcolepsy? What's happening there?
The main symptom of narcolepsy is that people are very sleepy. They may literally not be able to keep their eyes open while they're at work, or unfortunately, while they're driving, or when they're interacting with friends during a conversation. They might be intensely interested in what you are having to say, but they won't be able to stay awake at its most extreme sense. So sleepiness is very common. This same neurotransmitter system, though, affects patients with narcolepsy sometimes in other ways. One of the very classic ways is a symptom called cataplexy. And so with cataplexy, patients with narcolepsy, when they have certain emotions, laughter is a very common one. If they're laughing at something, sometimes being frightened, sometimes just excessive joy, they'll actually temporarily, they're awake, but they'll temporarily lose control of their muscles. And this can result in accidents, them dropping things or collapsing on the table or even collapsing on the floor. And it can be a very problematic symptom.
Oh, wow.
They also sometimes have the unfortunate tendency to act out their dreams. Most people, when we're sleeping, our brain essentially paralyzes our axial skeletal muscles, the muscles of our arms, legs, and trunk, so that we don't jump out the window when the dragon is chasing us in our dreams. But people with narcolepsy, sometimes, even though they're very sleepy, they may actually have kind of fragmented sleep.
All right. And what about circadian rhythm disorders?
For me, if I'm not changing time zones, as it begins to get dark, there's a surge in melatonin in my brain. This happens for most of our listeners here. And that is kind of the chemical marker that, hey, it's getting close to bedtime. And with that, then there's a series of changes that takes place in our bodies. Our core temperature will begin to fall a little bit. Our different parts of our body are kind of getting the signals that, hey, it's time for bed. And we tend to go to sleep. But we have abnormalities in the clock genes, or in some aspect of our programming, where we have some people who have what's called delayed sleep-wake phase syndrome. And so these are people who really, really, really have a hard time getting to sleep before, let's say, 2 o'clock in the morning. They genuinely are not sleepy at around midnight, 1 o'clock. And if we leave them alone on a deserted island or whatever, with no technology, you know, nobody to interact with, they really are going to naturally be getting sleepy around 2 o'clock-ish in the morning, and they'll want to sleep a full 8 hours, so they're really going to want to get up at 10.
You actually have a story about when our circadian rhythms can kind of betray us, when it becomes circadian rhythm sleep disorder. Tell us about that.
I was starting up a sleep practice outside of Nashville, and one of the things that I needed was to start up a sleep laboratory so I could measure people's sleep. And so I had a new sleep technologist who was coming, and we were kind of getting to know one another, and was, you know, trying to show her how I wanted the sleep studies to be done. And she was teaching me about, you know, her part of the job. And all of a sudden she said, "Why? I got to pick my daughter up." And I said, "Oh, what? Is there an emergency?" She said, "Oh, she fell asleep on the bus." And they didn't know that she was asleep on the bus. And now the bus is at the bus depot, and I've got to go pick her up from the bus depot. And it sounded like the way she said this, that this has happened before. And I said, "Well, has this happened before?" And she says, "Oh, yeah." And then she went on to describe to me that her kid kind of goes through these cycles of maybe about a month or month and a half, where during the day they just can't stay awake and they can't sleep at night. And then, boy, you know, you go like another month later and they're sleeping just fine at night and they're awake during the day just fine. And a little light bulb went off in my head. And I said, "You know, is your child blind?" And she said, "Yes, she's been blind from birth." And it turned out that there had been an infection at birth that had ruined her sight. She had no light sensation, you know, no light that could enter her brain. Well, guess what sets our time again each day? The Zeitgeber, or the time giver to our brain's clock, is light. So if there's no light, then the brain just runs at whatever time its normal period is. And it turns out that our internal clock is typically more like 24 hours and maybe 38 minutes or so. It's not 24 hours. And so for this child, every night, sleepy time is just a little bit later, regardless of what's going on with everybody else. And so she would just kind of, her clock would just run forward, and she would at times be super sleepy during the day, and at other times she'd be super sleepy at night. And it would just kind of run around like that. And guess what? One melatonin tablet taken in the evening could completely change that for her.
Fascinating.
Melatonin can be the time giver for her when the light can't. And so yes. I told that to my sleep technologist, and she never did leave my employment. She was very happy with me forever after because of the big difference that made in the life of her daughter.
Not sure if your sleep struggles qualify as a disorder? Well, keep your eye out for these red flags. One, have you set aside enough time to get the amount of sleep you need? If you have but still aren't able to sleep, that might be a disorder. Two, if you think you're sleeping well but still feel poorly rested, that might be a sleep disorder as well. And three, if you notice or if someone tells you you're exhibiting either of the following symptoms, that you snore loudly or stop breathing while you're sleeping, that might be a sleep disorder too. Some of the possible culprits might be sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome, narcolepsy, or insomnia. With insomnia, look to the 3P model. Do you have a predisposition to the disease? Is there a precipitating cause, something stressful in your life that's making your insomnia worse? And are there any perpetuating causes? Any habits you've acquired that have led to this disorder or are making it worse? If you suspect you might be suffering from a sleep disorder, check in with your care provider. Next, we'll answer commonly asked questions about sleep. Now, Dr. Morgenthaler, I think many of us have specific questions about sleep, particularly about our own sleep situations. I'm going to confess my own personal issue. I'm an aspirational morning person. I set my alarm for a much earlier time than I'm ever going to wake up, and then I hit snooze over and over and over again, much to my husband's chagrin. So technically, I'm still in bed for another hour each morning, but the sleep is very, very disrupted. Now, is that hurting me or is it helping me because I'm actually in bed longer?
We get asked this question a lot. And so the answer is not a simple yes-no question. I would say for most people, a snooze alarm is actually a bad idea. I know you're not going to like my answer.
I hate it. I hate it, Dr. Morgenthaler.
Most people, a snooze alarm is really probably not a good idea. And here's why. The studies show that, you know, when you use a snooze alarm, on average, you're losing about 6 minutes of sleep, you know. So you could kind of ask the question that, you know, you're saying you're an aspirational morning person, but we know eventually there's a time that you do get up, and I'll bet it's about the same time every morning. So if you're just, you know, going ahead and putting in one or two snooze alarms before that time, and if you're actually are kind of morning-ish or at least neutral in your chronotype.
And just to clarify, chronotype refers to that morning lark versus night owl inclination each person has.
Then you're probably just losing sleep. I'm not saying it's the worst thing you could do, but it's probably not very helpful. And you would be better off to just skip that and just, you know, set it for the time that you're going to get up and get up. There are some people, though, who are those evening chronotypes, the people who really have a really, really hard time getting up in the morning. It almost doesn't, unless it's almost late, late morning. They have what we call sleep inertia. I mean, they feel like they're in a green pea soup as they're getting up, and it might take an hour before their brain kind of sort of admits that it's awake. Those people, they actually may benefit from one or at most two snooze alarms. The studies that have been done show that if they put a snooze alarm maybe 30 minutes before the time that they really are going to get up, that may actually help them be in a little bit lighter stage of sleep as they wake up, and it may improve their sleep inertia. It still takes 6 minutes away from their sleep, but it might be a decent trade-off for compared to how they feel when they wake up.
What about menstrual cycles or menopause? How do those affect sleep?
Let's take the menstrual cycle first. Early in the cycle, as estrogen is growing, estrogen actually does tend to be helpful towards promoting sleep. Most people tend to get a little better sleep during their early menstrual cycle. And then the progesterone starts peaking. And the progesterone has kind of an adverse effect on how your body regulates temperature. And it actually may dampen the temperature cycle and make it a little harder to get a good night's sleep as that grows up. And then right immediately before the period, there's all kinds of craziness with the hormones there that leads to discomfort and leads to alterations in sleep. And particularly in people who have premenstrual syndrome, this can be a very difficult time for them to get decent sleep.
And now, what about menopause?
Now, with menopause, what we know is there's two things that start happening with more frequency. One of them is, especially in the perimenopausal time, there are a lot more complaints of insomnia and light sleep and sleep disruption. Some of that is related to hot flashes, although not all of it is related to hot flashes. And, I don't think anybody's exactly sure just all of the reasons why sleep is less stable during the perimenopausal period, but it certainly is. And we see a lot of women, coming for help during that time. Before menopause, obstructive sleep apnea tends to be much more common in men than in women. But after menopause, the women start catching up, and there is a significant tendency for them to start developing obstructive sleep apnea with higher frequency. And that's a very common disorder in both men and women after the menopausal age.
What about sleep and pregnancy? How does sleep affect pregnancy or vice versa?
Again, there's hormonal influences taking place during the different stages of pregnancy. Again, you've got the estrogen, the progesterone, and now you've got, luteal hormone and all these other things. And these all kind of affect the tendency to be able to sleep well. And on top of that, as the female body is changing and you're developing, this little being that's inside your lower abdomen, and it can be pressing on things and it can be moving, this little being makes a big difference on comfort levels. And so there can be a lot of discomfort with sleeping on your back or, on your sides for too long and things like that. It turns out that the hormonal milieu of pregnancy tends to make the cardiac output goes up dramatically, and the respiratory rate and ventilation goes up significantly. And at the same time, there is a tendency for fluid retention and some tendency towards weight gain. So sleep apnea and snoring can become much more common, particularly as we get, into the second and third trimester. And that sleep apnea can have a very adverse effect on pregnancy outcomes. Women who have obstructive sleep apnea that's not treated, they have a higher rate of preeclampsia and eclampsia. And, it's not good for infant mortality. So you do need to watch the sleep during pregnancy, and it's usually not as good as it is during other times. So it's a challenge.
Now, we want to know what we can do to sleep better. There's obviously a lot of conventional wisdom out there, turn off your devices an hour before bed, don't drink coffee too late, etc. What other behavioral changes can we make for a better night's sleep?
If you're a person who's having trouble sleeping, here's what I would suggest. I would suggest sit down and think very carefully, what time do you really want to get up in the morning? And is that reasonable?
Note taken for myself, yes.
You do have to think, what time is that's going to work most often? And so let's say, I'm just making this up, but let's say it's 7 o'clock. Okay, 7 o'clock shall be the hour then. And you really should admit every day, you should wake up at 7 o'clock. Now I know, what about the weekend? Okay, give yourself a little grace, 7:30. But basically it should be 7 o'clock. So we should be regular in that. So step number one, pick a sleep time and stick with it. Step number two, you're going to love this, spend less time in bed. Whoa, you didn't expect to hear that from me, did you?
No.
A lot of people who have trouble sleeping, they're spending a lot of time in bed, but a lot of the time that they're in bed, they're awake. So what we really want you to do is to, if 7 o'clock is the time that you're going to get up every morning, count backward from that at least 7 hours. And say, okay, I'm not going to go to bed much before midnight, if that's really the time that you're going to get up. Because we know that if you're a healthy sleeper, you need about 7 hours of sleep. So if you go to bed at 10, and you only need 7 hours, guess what? You're probably going to spend 2 hours of sleep awake. So at least initially, pick something that is, you know, not too much time in bed, starting with the wake-up time and counting backwards. Step number three, if you're not asleep, don't stay in bed. And what I mean by that is, suppose you're, you know, you've done this crazy thing that Dr. Morgenthaler suggested, and you're in bed, and gosh, it feels like it's been 20 minutes, 30 minutes. I'm frustrated. I'm not falling asleep. We would suggest, if you would please, leave the bed, go someplace comfortable in another room if you have it, you know, like an easy chair or on the couch. Do something that is, you know, not too stimulating, but not too annoying. Read, do a crossword puzzle, something that's like that, until you feel really sleepy. And that's where you follow step number four. Only go to bed when you're sleepy, when you have a high likelihood that you're going to fall asleep. And if you do those four things very regularly and persistently, most people's sleep will really improve.
Should we keep our bedroom at a certain temperature, you know, other environmental factors?
Well, we know from studies that most people do sleep better when it's cooler than when it's warmer. And by cooler, some studies would say, you know, if you can keep the temperature between like 68 and 75 degrees Fahrenheit, that's probably the best bedroom temperature for people. Once it starts getting over 80 degrees, we know that people's sleep quality tends to deteriorate. Now, not everybody can do that. You know, if you are able to do that, that's optimal. We know that dark is better than light. Some people are very sensitive to light. For me, if I close my eyes, it's pretty close to dark enough. For my wife, if there's an LED five rooms away with three doors in between us, who knows about it? So some people are very light sensitive. And if that's the case, then, you know, go ahead and get some of the darkening goggles and so forth, because that really can help. And make sure that you're getting plenty of light exposure during the day, no matter who you are, because we know that that light dark difference can make a big difference in your sleep.
Any tips about should we wear certain clothes to bed?
There are studies, again, that suggest that it's easier to regulate your temperature by using things like cotton or natural fibers rather than polyester fibers that tend to be a little bit clammier and keep the moisture in. But I think those things are fine-tuning and probably very individual.
Any tips for nappers out there, people who want to be better at taking a nap each day?
Yeah. Well, I love naps. I think naps are a great idea. And, you know, of course, there's only two risks of naps. One is, you know, that you get caught taking a nap when something else was supposed to be happening. Hopefully that's not the case. But the second one is that you nap too long. So, you know, the ideal time duration, I should say, for a nap is probably 20 to 30 minutes. If you can take 20 to 30 minute nap, for most people, they find that very refreshing. For most people, that's not going to make a huge impact on being able to fall asleep at night, you know, or stay asleep at night. You should figure that into your total sleep time as you do your calculations. But for most people, especially if you take that nap kind of in the mid to late afternoon, it feels very good and it can be very refreshing.
Dr. Morgenthaler, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for sharing so much wisdom, so many facts. I learned so much.
Well, thank you. It's been delightful.
Now, this one might be hard to believe, but snooze alarms, for the most part, are not our friends. In fact, we end up losing sleep whenever we use them. For women, our biology can really affect our sleep. Menstrual cycles and hormones can either help or hurt our sleep, depending on where we are in the month. And menopause, along with hot flashes, can often mean insomnia, lighter sleep, and sleep disruption for many women. After menopause, many women can develop obstructive sleep apnea. Pregnancy also affects our sleep. First, there's the hormones, then the baby kicking in your womb, along with fluid retention and weight gain, which can lead to increased discomfort and disrupt sleep. Cardiac output also goes up dramatically, along with respiratory rate and ventilation. Sleep apnea and snoring become more common in the second and third trimester. It's important to treat during pregnancy, as women who don't can have a higher rate of preeclampsia and eclampsia. So, how can all of us sleep better in our day-to-day or our night-to-night? Well, start by thinking about when you want to get up. Then count back at least 7 hours and set that as your bedtime. And most of all, stay consistent. If you need to nap during the day, keep it short, about 20 to 30 minutes. Next, spend less time in bed. You want to spend the majority of time there actually sleeping. So don't hit the hay much earlier than when you actually fall asleep. And if you're not asleep, don't stay in bed. And last, set up your nighttime environment for the most success. Keep your bedrooms cool, dark, and wear cotton or natural fibers to sleep. And most of all, sleep well and sweet dreams. Okay, that's all for this episode. But if you've got a question or topic suggestion, you can leave us a voicemail at 507-538-6272. We might even feature your voice on the show. For more information on the Mayo Clinic Guide to Better Sleep, check out our show notes. For more Health Matters episodes and resources, head to mayoclinic.org/healthmatters. And if you found this show helpful, please subscribe and make sure to rate and review us in your podcast app. It really does help others find the show. Thanks for listening. And until next time, take care and stay healthy. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as medical or legal advice. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for any medical questions. The appearance of any guest does not imply an endorsement of them, their employer, or any entity they represent. The views and opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of Mayo Clinic. Reference to any product, service, or entity does not constitute an endorsement of or recommendation by Mayo Clinic.